Right now, though, we're in Acts 21. I got to remind myself to finish strong, too. Okay, because I'm wanting to leave. Chapter 21, verse 27. Paul has made it to Jerusalem. He has come to Jerusalem, and he gets there, and he starts to give his report. And it's actually a really good report. He tells the leaders of the church, James and the elders, he's like, man, what you guys commissioned me and Barnabas to do several years ago is exploding. Just exploding. All around the world. All around the world. Gentiles are hearing your message, hearing the message of the gospel, and they are responding. And that causes them great celebration. But what causes them a little bit of hesitation? What causes them, what causes Paul maybe some trepidation or frustration?
The comments that are zealous for
the law. Yeah, the report of James and the elders. They're like, hey, yeah, well, I'm glad the Gentiles ministry is going well because the Jewish one is too. I mean, thousands have come to know Jesus here in Jerusalem. And they're all very zealous for the law. As a matter of fact, Paul, there's rumors going around that what you're telling the Gentiles, it's just to throw Moses out completely, ignoring all the customs. They're not too happy about it. Paul's already known that this was going to be a rough ministry in Jerusalem. Why? What's that? Because the Spirit has revealed it to the people that he's been going to. My goodness, I'm forgetting the city that he was in whenever they freaked out. Tyre, goodness, I was wanting to say Troas, I knew that wasn't right. In Tyre, they said, hey, through the Spirit, they urge him not to go. Whenever Paul is up in Antioch, all of a sudden you see Agabus comes up there and he makes his own prediction, does he not? What's the prediction that he makes? He goes over, grabs a belt, and binds his hands and his feet. And he says, this is what the Spirit says you have to look forward to in Jerusalem. And Paul gets into Jerusalem and he realizes, I probably know what the issue is going to be. Because, man, while there's thousands of Jews that have converted, they're all zealous for the law and there's bad rumors going around about me. Now, what is James and the elders, what is their solution to try to defuse this ticking time bomb? Say that again? For him to pay for the vow of four other Christians, right? There are four Christians that have made a modified Nazirite vow or a Nazirite vow of some sort. And what they would need to do is cut their hair, shave their hair, take their hair, burn it on the altar, and then pay the price for the actual completion of that vow. And James and the others say, we have an idea. We want you to go and be the one that pays the price, that actually offers the money to complete this vow. They said, then what this will be is this will be a moment in which the people will see that you're not against all the Jewish customs, that you actually are participating in them because you do affirm what Moses says on some level. This is supposed to be the remedy for the situation, which actually leads into what eventually gets him bound. Whoops. We're in verse 27 of chapter 21. When the 7 days were nearly over, some Jews from the province of Asia saw Paul at the temple. The 7 days of what? The festival, the Jewish festival that they're in. Okay? More than likely, I believe this is the festival of Pentecost and not Passover. And that's significant because Paul didn't make it back when he wanted to, but he still made it back nonetheless. When the 7 days were nearly over, some Jews from the province of Asia saw Paul at the temple. Now notice where these Jews are from. Where are they from? Province of Asia. Why is that significant? Why does Luke add that detail? What's that? Initially in his ministry, he was not allowed to go there, right? He tries to go into Asia, wasn't allowed to go there. Tries to go to Bithynia, isn't allowed to go there. Eventually goes to Macedonia. Why else is this important? Say it again. What's that?
Did they follow him?
Did they follow him? What they're going to be doing to him in a moment is going to indicate that they probably don't follow him. Matter of fact, they hate him. More than likely not. They're probably there for the festival. But that's a good thought, because normally that is what the Jewish enemies of Paul are doing. They follow him around. But you said a prepositional phrase, from Asia. What does that indicate? What's that? No, the Jews are, but what it indicates is that Paul has been to Asia. He was kept from it initially, but he did go to Asia. As a matter of fact, what city is the capital of Asia Minor, of Asia? Ephesus. Right? How long does Paul spend in Ephesus? 2.5 to 3 years. Paul is hanging out in Ephesus for 3 years. How does his ministry in Ephesus end just 2 chapters earlier? Rioting. At the hands of what person? Mm-hmm. Demetrius. And remember, whenever Demetrius is upset, he gathers all the silversmiths and all the other people of the trade guilds, and he says, they are shaming Artemis, they're ripping us off, they're stealing our money, we got to do something about them. So they go, cause a riot in the marketplace, which eventually leads down to the amphitheater. They start chanting, you know, great is Artemis of the Ephesians. And then remember, before they chant for 2 hours straight, remember what happens right in the middle. It's only 2 or 3 verses. But who is first pushed out to go talk to them? Alexander. And why do the people freak out on Alexander? Because he was a Jew. More than likely, the reason why Alexander was put out there in front to talk to them was to try to tell them that there was a difference between the Jews and the Christians. The people you're upset about, Paul, while he is Jewish, he is not us. He is not a Jew. We don't claim him as our people. Instead, he is a part of a Jewish sect known as Christianity, and we hate them too. Before he can give this explanation, though, what happens? The amphitheater freaks out. They run him off the stage and chant, great is Artemis the Ephesians, for the next 2 hours. Demetrius, after the city clerk shuts down the riot, Demetrius probably didn't give up his ministry of violence or of persecution. But not just against Christians, probably also against Jews. So now you have these Jews coming from the province of Asia, and they notice Paul. They've been experiencing a lot of trouble the past year and a half or so after Paul left Ephesus at the hands of Demetrius because of what Paul stirred up. Before Paul got there, everything was peaceful. Before Paul got there, their ministries, their communities, their families were not being persecuted. After Paul leaves, they can barely live in the city that they've grown up in. They're not fans of Paul because of what Paul left them. You see what's happening? More than likely, who felt the brunt end of the ministry of Demetrius in Ephesus were the Jews. Because the Romans were not worried about the religious separation points between Jews and Christians. You following me? Is this making sense? Or do I need to keep explaining it? I'm seeing some blank looks. Do we want me to keep explaining it? Let me keep explaining it, because I'm not getting any affirmations. In Ephesus, when Paul leaves, what Demetrius was upset about was monotheism spreading in the city of Ephesus that was destroying his ministry for the goddess Artemis. Monotheism is the key tenet of both Judaism and Christianity. Okay? You following me now? So, he is ticked off at Paul, who he thinks is a Jew, and he is, and all the Jews that are promoting monotheism that's destroying his business. So he not only is persecuting Paul, but the very fact that Alexander goes up there to give a defense, when they found out he was a Jew, they say, you're part of the problem too. And they run him off stage. Now, these Jews, they come down to Jerusalem for the festival from the province of Asia. And they've been experiencing great difficulties at the hands of Demetrius after Paul has left to go into Macedonia. And they're saying, we want revenge. Is this making sense now? Can I get some hollers? Okay, are you just asleep or? Okay. When the 7 days were nearly over, some Jews from the province of Asia, probably Ephesus, saw Paul at the temple. They stirred up the whole crowd and seized him. Why? Why are they seizing him? I've just explained it for 10 minutes. Why are they upset with him? Why are they seizing him? Because he was the main problem in the province of Asia that's caused persecution for them. And they want revenge. shouting, "Men of Israel, help us! This is the man who teaches all men everywhere against our people and our law, and this very place." What place? The temple. Sounds similar accusations that were thrown at Stephen, doesn't it? Acts chapter 6. He speaks against the law, and he speaks against God Himself, and he even speaks against the temple. And besides, he adds on an accusation. He has brought Greeks into the temple area and defiled this holy place. We actually have an inscription on a rock. It's in Jerusalem. Well, it was originally. I don't think it is there anymore. But we actually have an inscription on a rock that was been in the court of Gentiles, in the temple area where the Gentiles were allowed to be. And it was on this particular stone that separated the court of the Gentiles and the place, the inner place for the Jews. Not the Holy of Holies, but for the Jews. Because the Gentiles that were on the outside looking in on the covenant, they were allowed to be in the temple, but not in the inner sanctum of the temple. That's where only the Jews could go. But on this rock, separating the court of the Gentiles and the court of the men, or the court of the Israelites, it says this: "Any Gentile who is caught trespassing beyond this point will have himself to blame for his death, which will soon follow." What do you hear that? Jews are saying, "You cross this point, Gentiles, you have your own self to blame for when we kill you." And what's the accusation that they're bringing against Paul here? He has brought one of the Gentiles into the inner sanctum, into the place where he did not belong. This accusation would have been taken very seriously because of the zeal for the purity of the temple of God. God's temple had to be pure of the disgusting, cooties-ridden Gentiles. And if they come in there, not only will they die, but the person that's responsible for bringing them in should be killed as well. So he looks at him and he says, not only is this guy turning everybody against us all over the empire, but the problem with this guy also is he is defiling the laws of Moses, even defiling the temple itself. As a matter of fact, let me give you an example. The Jews from Asia Minor say, "We saw him bring a Greek into the court of the Jews." It says in verse 29 in parentheses, "They had previously seen Trophimus the Ephesian." Stop. Trophimus the Ephesian. Why is that important? Yeah, if these Jews are from Asia, in the city of Ephesus, where Paul has caused all kinds of problems, and they look over and they see Trophimus and they say, "We grew up with him. We know he's a Gentile. We know he's a pagan." Trophimus the Ephesian in the city, they saw Trophimus the Ephesian in the city with Paul and assumed that Paul had brought him into the temple area. You see their logic? They see Paul earlier on in the week and they're like, "Was that Paul? Well, man, I know that was Trophimus. I saw him. Huh. Wonder what they're doing here. I mean, they hate this place. Why would they come to one of the key festivals? They teach against the law of Moses. Just even ask the Jewish Christians. They hate this place, and yet he's here." Later on in the week, they see Paul, and they say, "We know why he's here. He's here to defile the temple on one of the greatest festivals that we have." How did he do it? He probably took his companion, his traveling buddy, Trophimus, in the temple itself. The accusation should have resulted in death. And that's why the people flip out. Verse 21. "The whole city was aroused, and the people came running from all directions. Seizing Paul, they dragged him from the temple, and immediately the gates were shut." Did you hear that? What happens when gates are shut? Yeah, they can do whatever they want, right? If you're wanting to do something that you know is illegal, if you're wanting to do something where you just want justice, because here's the problem. Even though they have this designation that says Gentiles that move past this point, they have only themselves to blame for their death, which will soon follow. Even though they make that threat, the Jews know as well as everybody else that they do not have the right to mete out capital punishment. That is Rome's job. They don't have that legal right. Which is one of the reasons why you see the Jewish elite bringing Jesus up before Pontius Pilate. If they wanted Jesus dead and they had the power to do it themselves, they wouldn't have asked somebody else to help them. They would have just killed him themselves. But the Jews know if they go around killing people, that Rome will take its iron fist and crush them. And as a result, the Jews always used Rome to get what they needed, unless it dealt with the purity of the temple. Then they said, we're even willing for Rome to crush us in order to protect the purity of God. So they close the gates and they're saying, Rome, don't even worry about what happens behind the gates. We'll take care of it. Don't even worry. We got it. Because they know what they're doing is illegal, and yet their zeal for the purity of the temple causes people to run from all directions. They're freaking out. Yes?
I had a question.
Go ahead.
When Paul comes and James is telling him about these Jewish converts, but they're all zealous for the law, and like, I don't know. I guess what laws would have, like the early Messianic Jews or whatever, like the Jewish converts, like what laws would they have saw as obligatory to like keep? Like what what did they still have to do? Because it seemed like, I don't know, and is that still like applicable? Like things from the,
Absolutely. Yeah. Let me answer the first part of the question.
Okay.
The first question is things like dietary laws. Clean and unclean. Very important. Why? Why were the clean and unclean laws set down to begin with? To show that they were a distinct and separate nation from all the pagan nations of the world. There was something different about these people. The point was, God was trying to set them aside as completely different so that the other nations would see they're different and then ask, why are you different? It was intentionally so that the Gentiles would be attracted to them. But the Jews began to use that as a means to keep the Gentiles out. We are different than them. See how they switched it? Dietary laws were huge because it literally gave them their identity as a separate nation, God's nation. What other laws? Sabbath law. Huge for the Jews. Notice, all I'm doing is tracing even through Jesus' ministry all the ones that he revoked. Big deal. You'll get crucified if you start revoking these commands. Sabbath law, that's one of the top four commandments in the Ten Commandments. You obey the Sabbath. And yet, Jesus comes and he says, actually, Sabbath was made for man, not for the Sabbath. Therefore, it's okay to do good on the Sabbath. Even maybe traveling in order to go spread the gospel. It's okay. Another one. Sacrificial atonement. How do you atone for your sacrifices? Whenever you're saying Jesus is the atonement of all, you don't even need the temple anymore to accomplish its primary goal, and that is to provide the salvation for the nation of Israel. That's a big problem. As a matter of fact, I was lecturing on it in the Gospel of Mark this morning, is Jesus even does say that the temple will be destroyed because we don't need it anymore. For the Jews, you don't need the place where God dwells anymore? No, because they're not understanding Jeremiah 31. Okay, now God is dwelling in us. Big difference. We are the temple because we are where heaven and earth intersect. Another law they would have been very zealous about is circumcision. And circumcision, I mean, we read Genesis 17 in here. Circumcision has things attached to it like, this is an everlasting covenant that is to be passed on to your children or your children's children forever. And anyone that doesn't have this covenantal mark will be cut off from my people. Anyway, sorry, my mind was going somewhere else. The point is, those four laws, just by themselves, they hold very near and dear to their heart. And what does Paul do with all four? What is the message of Jesus regarding all four? We don't need them anymore. These four by themselves is what made them who they were. This was their identity. This is how, this disobeying laws like this is what got them thrown into the exile to begin with. Their rebellion. And whenever these Christians are coming along and they are saying, we don't need these anymore because Jesus fulfilled them, they're saying, you're leading us into a path of rebellion, into more exile, not actually bringing us to the truth. Now, with all that in place, now let's add a fifth one. Jesus is God in the flesh. For a monotheistic religion that is so zealous about blasphemy that they're even willing to kill people that commit it, saying that Jesus deserves to be worshipped as God is a major problem. You add all of these up, and it's going to cause not only a lot of problems for the Jews, because the Christians are much more intent on proselytizing the Gentiles, but also because they think they're making a mockery of the God Himself. And the Jews then were just were as passionate about the purity of the name of God or the protecting the honor of God as some Muslims are today, not all of them. But you can see the context. And there's actually something about that zeal that is frightening and yet also beautiful all at the same time. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I mean, Christians should be ashamed if we compare our zeal for the gospel with the zeal of some other religions. We should be ashamed. We won't even cross the street to tell someone about the gospel. But at least they're willing to even blow themselves up for it. I'm not saying that's what we need to be doing, is blowing ourselves up. But what I'm saying is they understand commitment and trust and faith better than we do, and we actually have the truth. I just watched last night this, I don't remember, I can't even say the guy's name, but the Penn Teller, how do you say his name? Some like magician, comedian guy, Penn something. Yeah, that guy. I watched his little rant after one of his shows on YouTube last night of a guy that came up to him, and he's a pretty passionate atheist. This Penn, what is his name?
Gillette?
Gillette, like the razor? Yeah. Okay. Penn Gillette. I don't even know how to pronounce the word Gillette. You know, see my problem? Penn Gillette, he's a passionate atheist. Very outspoken on YouTube and on other different media venues of his atheism. And he starts talking about this guy that came up to him at the end of one of his shows. He said the guy had been there the night before and had some of the props from the show from the night before that they give out. And he said basically the man gives him like a Gideon Bible that has the New Testament and the Psalms. And Penn Gillette said, he goes, now this man even knew I was an atheist. He said, but he was genuinely complimenting me. And he just kept saying over and over how much he appreciated my humor, how much he appreciated my social commentary, how much he just appreciated. He said he genuinely was complimenting me and loving me. And he goes, now I'm not going to be converted by one nice guy being a good man. He said, but if Christians really believe, if any religion really believes that they have the truth, he says, then they should be proselytizing with a force. This is an atheist saying this. He said, they should be proselytizing with everything that's in them. He said, because how evil do you have to be to believe that you have the truth and not want to give it to anyone? That you have the truth that will save them and not give it. He said, how evil do you have to be to keep it to yourself? He said, and this is his example. He says, it's like if I see that there is a truck that's barreling down the road towards this guy and the guy's refusing to say there's a truck, he said, eventually I'll tackle the guy and get him out of the way. He said, so I respect this. He said, it was a good man. Basically, he says, and if I'm going to be converted, it would be by a guy like that who actually believes that he has the truth and he doesn't want to leave this world without telling someone like me that doesn't believe in it. So you almost have this clarion call from an atheist for Christians to actually stand up if they believe they have what is right to start telling people about it. I found that both ironic, beautiful, and sad all at the same time. Because I was like, really? We have to have atheists to tell us how to do this? We can't just get this on our own? I mean, it's kind of like there's a book, or I mean, an article in the New York Times, this would have been about 2 years ago now, by a guy named Matthew Paris called, As an Atheist, I Truly Believe That Africa Needs God. That's the title. And basically, it's a plea for Christians to go and start feeding the hungry and taking care of those in Africa and giving them their faith. He said, because I've seen the difference between people that only feed their body and treat their body. He says, and what Africa needs is an entire faith transplant because they have no hope. He says, and they're still dying at a rapid pace because while they have the medicine that's coming in, they have no hope with which to sustain them. And I'm reading this going, we're debating on whether or not we should be feeding their body or their souls. And this atheist is asking Christians to come and do both, please. Why do we need atheists to tell us our mission? Can't we get this right? It's very simple. You go and you feed and you love and you feed their souls and their bodies and do whatever you can to love them into the gospel. Because if you have the truth, and the truth is that even if you die, you resurrect and come to a new life. That even if you are persecuted to the point of death, that you will immediately be in the presence of Jesus. What will that not stop you from doing? I mean, The problem is that most of us don't believe that's true, and that's why you don't do anything. Most of you just don't think the resurrection is true. You don't allow it to empower you to be who God wants you to be. And if we did, we might be able to say some of the same things as Paul. I know this will lead to my suffering, but I trust Him. If your theology is accurate and you truly believe it, I don't know what you're waiting for. And in light of the missionary convention, I think that's a very appropriate message. I don't even know what we were talking about. That's why they were mad. They were zealous. I know what I was saying is I actually in some sense admire their zeal. I wish we had more of it. The difference between our zeal and theirs is that they want to lay down other people's lives and we need to lay down our own. That's the key difference. You're fine.
Do Messianic Jews today still follow like dietary laws and all that?
Some do.
It's more of like a heritage.
If it is for a heritage, I'm okay with that. Mm-hmm. If they just, you know, hey, I'm just paying homage to my forefathers and stuff like that, my you know, actually ethnic, I'm okay with that. What I don't like, and there's even some people on this campus, that suggest that this is actually still required. And I'm just looking at them going, you must not have read Acts very closely, or Galatians, or Romans, or Revelation, or... yeah. So, no, I mean, I have no problem with people keeping the festivals. No problem even trying to be kosher. I don't have a problem with that. As long as they're doing it for, hey, this I'm just doing this in honor of my forefathers. But they understand that that's not what defines us as a people, as a follower of Christ. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely.
So, okay, any other questions? Yeah, go ahead.
The whole one about the Sabbath kind of confuses me, just because the other four, or the other three, sorry, seem like they're kind of grown out almost, but with the Sabbath, most of the, throughout Scripture, we still see them celebrating it. Like, Jesus did say that Sabbath was his earth.
Right, absolutely. But it doesn't mean that we have to keep the Sabbath as if we break it, then God's going to throw us into rebellion. What I think Jesus is looking at more is this, is why did God give you a Sabbath? This is my theology of Sabbath. God gave you a Sabbath because He knows if you have a consistent rhythm of hard work and rest, then you will more easily connect to Him spiritually. The reason why, see, the Sabbath law is fascinating too because it's in the first four of the Ten Commandments. First four are about this relationship. And the last six of the Ten Commandments are about this relationship, the horizontal relationship. Don't lie, don't steal, don't cheat, you know. And the Sabbath's in the first four. Why? Because if you violate Sabbath on a consistent basis, if you do not have a part of your rhythm, times of rest, you will spiritually be deficient. So I'm not saying that Jesus eradicated it in the sense of never ever again do you have to rest. Nevertheless, I do believe that Jesus says, and yet, this isn't something that you have to keep meticulously the way that the Pharisees did. There are seasons whenever I go 3-4 weeks and don't get a Sabbath. Now, that is not healthy. And that's something that my wife and my community try to make sure I keep intact. Nevertheless, I'm not sinning in that moment. I'm not. And that's the key point, is Jesus is saying, wait a minute, you've actually taken the Sabbath and enslaved people to it. And the whole point of the Sabbath was to free you to be able to interact with God on a way in which He knows you better than you know you. He created you. He knows your bodies can't go sustained for a long period of time without rest. Therefore, He's going to put it actually in the law to get your attention and say, you need to do this. You need to do that. You need to rest. And when you do, spiritually, you're much more intact. Spiritually, you're much more connected to God. And when you violate it, it affects you physically, emotionally, as well as spiritually. So Jesus says, understand it as a gift to you, not something to enslave you. And the way in which it was being used was through His enslavement. Does that make sense? Understand the purpose of the Sabbath, and then you understand why it got made the top 10 anyway. It's so that spiritually you can be connected with God. Nevertheless, Jesus doesn't say, if you violate the Sabbath in three consecutive weeks, and I happen to come back in the fourth week before you hit your Sabbath, you're going to hell. You're just going straight there. Why? Because you didn't rest. Now you'll never rest. You like that? You know, I mean, that's not Jesus. That's just not who he is. Does that make sense? Okay, where are we at? Verse 30? Any other questions before I move on to verse 30? The whole city was aroused, and the people came running from all directions, seizing Paul. They dragged him from the temple, and immediately the gates were shut. While they were trying to kill him, I don't know if like, you know, the sword won't go in. I don't know what's happening there. While they were trying to kill him, news reached the Roman commander, or the commander of the Roman troops, that the whole city of Jerusalem was in an uproar. He at once took some officers and soldiers and ran down to the crowd. When the rioters saw the commander and his soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. See, during the time of the Jewish festivals, especially Pentecost, especially Passover, they always would have Roman soldiers on hand for these very reasons. Because Rome's primary task is to keep peace in the empire. That's their primary task, to keep peace. But the way in which Rome keeps peace is by being so brutal and so violent that you are absolutely afraid of doing anything that would bring down the fist of Rome. They don't keep peace by just, man, everybody's just so happy that nobody wants to cause problems because it's just so tranquil here. It's so delightful. That's not how the peace of Rome was accomplished. The peace of Rome was accomplished where people were so afraid of Rome that they didn't want to do anything to have Rome actually wake up and come after them. Which is one of the reasons why you see the gates being shut. Shut the gates. We got something to do. We don't want Rome to see. And what they don't see won't hurt them. But Rome hears the whole city's in an uproar. And it is this guy's job to keep the peace. Even if it means using the army. Well, this is so ironic. To keep the peace. Even if it means killing people in order to make sure the peace is kept. Keeping peace with a sword is a difficult thing to do. Usually it just causes more problems eventually. It's called a spiral of violence. More violence breeds more violence. That's the way it normally happens. They stop beating Paul, though. They come in and they're like, oh, geez, you have swords. You know, we just have little pheasants that we were going to sacrifice on an altar. Yeah, you win, you know. So they stop beating Paul and they just stand there. I don't know what happened. He just fell down the stairs, you know. Actually, that's really sad because some people... Anyway, verse 33, the commander came up and arrested him. Arrested who? Paul. Why? Yeah, the guy's like bloody mess and he's like, arrest that man. Like what? If you're keeping peace and you see the key target of people's aggression, you grab him and pull him out of the situation so you can figure out what's going on. It's just a logical move. They know that Paul, they can at least arrest him. They know he is part of the problem. Obviously, the guys that have blood stains over their tunics probably are some of the problem too. Nevertheless, Paul seems to be the key point of contention. So they go, they arrest him and order him to be bound with two chains. Why does Luke add that detail? Because of the prophecy of Agabus. Exactly where these chains are placed, we cannot verify with clarity. Nevertheless, if we take Agabus's prophecy seriously, it is more likely these two chains were being used to bind his hands and his feet. The two chains being used to bind his hand and his feet. Then he asked who he was and what he had done. He arrests him and says, "What's your problem? Why are you causing us all this mess?" Some of the crowd shouted one thing and some another. And since the commander could not get at the truth because of the uproar, he ordered that Paul be taken in the barracks. I mean, you can just imagine that situation. What have you done, Paul? He's done this. He's done this. And everybody starts yelling and rioting again. He's like, all right, shut up. Just go in the barracks. The barracks would have been referring to what was called the Antonian Tower. In the time, Pompey, in the first century BC, when Pompey comes in and takes back over the temple, because remember the Jews took over their temple from the Greeks, when the Greeks had it, they overthrow them through the Maccabean Revolt, etc. They take back over their temple. Whenever Pompey comes in, the Roman general, he looks at him and he says, this tower, not going to happen. And the reason why is the Maccabeans, they erected that tower so that, from the tower's perspective, they could have a better vantage point on the enemies. They could see where they were coming and launch out a better attack. Pompey comes in and destroys it. He says, I don't want you having any weapons against the enemies because you look at me as the enemy. Herod the Great, who takes over for Rome after Pompey's death, he constructs it again. Because, but what it was used for was during the festivals, the Roman soldiers would go and they would use the Antonian Tower as their barracks, as the place from which they could see all that was happening and keep order, to keep peace. It's actually named for Mark Antony, who would have been the benefactor, the one that it was being developed. Matter of fact, this is more than likely the tower or the barracks that Jesus was taken into whenever he was beaten to a pulp by the Roman soldiers at his trial. See the connections between Paul and Jesus? Because that's where he's taken, and it's going to get worse. Some of the crowd shouted one thing, blah, 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 blah. Verse 35. When Paul reached the steps, the violence of the mob was so great, he had to be carried by the soldiers. They were ripping at him. They're like, no, we want him. We want him dead. The soldiers end up having to carry him into the barracks. The crowd that followed kept shouting, away with him. Or you can even maybe even hear in the background, crucify him. Although that isn't ultimately what they're looking for. Just death. It doesn't matter how. As the soldiers were about to take Paul into the barracks, he asked the commander, may I say something to you? Do you speak Greek? He replied. More than likely, Paul could have spoken in four languages. Aramaic, because that was the native tongue of the Jews. Hebrew, because that was the native tongue of their scriptures. Latin, because that was the native tongue of the Romans. And Greek, because that's what pretty much everybody spoke. That is not normal in the ancient world. That is not even normal in our country. I say our country because actually you go across the world and every other country you go to can at least speak more than one language. We're very deprived in that area is the probably more accurate term. There's imperial reasons of why that happened, but we don't have time to go into them. Do you speak Greek? He replied. Aren't you the Egyptian who started a revolt and led 4,000 terrorists out into the desert some time ago? Who does the Roman commander think he has here? He thinks he has an insurrectionist, the leader of a political revolution, a guerrilla warrior, somebody that just some time ago, matter of fact, it would have been about 7 years earlier, some time ago, this man, probably around four, because this would have been around 58 or 59, and we think that the Egyptian that led them into would have been around 54. And this Egyptian actually leads several thousand people at the time of Pentecost or Passover, right around in that time period, in revolt against the Roman Empire as a messianic figure. Whenever Rome comes in and they crush it, they wipe out almost all of his soldiers, but the Egyptian got away. And the Roman soldier says, we got him. That's what he thinks has happened. But what shocks him is whenever this Egyptian starts speaking fluent Greek at him. Something that he didn't think the Egyptian would have. He would probably have been speaking Aramaic or Hebrew or something like that. So you speak Greek? Paul answered, I am a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no ordinary city. What does he leave out? Yeah, no reason to tell him that yet. We'll pull that trump card when we need it. Please let me speak to the people. Kind of sounds like Ephesus again. They're about to rip you apart. Yeah, I know. Can I just talk to him for a second? And what's so funny is every time Paul wants to do that, usually it gets worse. Mark Moore says all the time, he says he loves how Paul continually overestimates his ability to calm a violent crowd. He does it all the time. He's like, oh, I'll talk to him. They want to kill you. It'll be fine. And no, it won't. Having received the commander's permission, Paul stood on the steps and motioned to the crowd. When they were all silent, he said to them in Aramaic. Notice, he can switch. He's very astute, very erudite. Brothers and fathers, listen now to my defense. Apologia, an apologetic. Listen to how I'm defending this. Yes?
ESV says in verse 40,
Yeah, there's a textual variant that's an argument over. It's possibly Hebrew. It is the word Aramaic in the Greek, but there is a textual variant where it does say Hebrew. Bottom line is he's speaking the native tongue of the people that are in front of him. And the two reasons why that's significant. Number one is because he is showing that he is speaking their language. He is like them. But number two, more than likely the Roman soldier or centurion or commander would not have been able to understand whatever language he was speaking. So there is a textual variant in argument. Aramaic and Hebrew, though, are very, very closely similar. Matter of fact, Daniel chapters, 1 through, I think it's 7:12, or it might right before 7, is all in Hebrew. And then for the next three chapters, it switches to Aramaic, and then it switches back to Hebrew. So even within Daniel itself, we have a switching from Aramaic to Hebrew. And if you want to know Aramaic, learn Hebrew first, and then it will be a hop, skip, and a jump to get to Aramaic. Okay. Brothers and fathers, listen now to my defense. When they heard him speak to them in Aramaic, they became very quiet. Why? He's speaking our language. Then Paul said, Paul will have 4 points in this sermon, and the sermon will be stopped. It will be cut off before he can get to his final point. The first point that he gives here is his identity. I am a Jew. I am a kosher Jew. You're accusing me of something that is not true. I am actually very zealous for what you guys are zealous about. But the problem is you're stopping short of its fulfillment. But the very first point, I am a Jew, is identity. The second point, which comes in verses 4 through 5, is his previous actions. I used to be a persecutor of the church, Paul says. Number 3, his third point, coming verses 6 through 16 of chapter 22, is his repentance. He tells his conversion story again. Then in chapter 4, verses 17, number 4, verses 17 through 21, he gives his mission. His mission is to evangelize the Gentiles. And that will end the sermon because that's what ticks him off. Very first point, though, in verse 3, I am a Jew born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city. He says, I'm not just a visitor like a lot of you. This is my hometown. I grew up here. So I know a lot of you are sojourners passing through, but this is my hometown. So don't act like I'm some subservient Jew. I grew up here. And then he goes on and he says, and I'm even better to you in other ways. Under Gamaliel, I was thoroughly trained in the law of our fathers and was just as zealous for God as any of you are today. He says, matter of fact, I was more zealous than you. I was trained under Gamaliel himself, one of the key rabbis that all of you revere and honor. He was my personal teacher while I grew up in this city. And then he says, verse 4, as a matter of fact, I persecuted the followers of this way to their death, arresting both men and women, throwing them into prison, as also the high priest and all the council can testify. He says, you think that you're zealous against these Christians? First of all, I grew up here. I was trained under Gamaliel, which is better than anything you guys can claim. I was more zealous because I was actually arresting, persecuting, and killing them. And the high priest was the one that gave me the permission to do it. Have any of you met the high priest? Yeah, him and I used to be pretty close friends. So don't act like you're more kosher than me. He goes on and he says, I even obtained letters from them to their brothers in Damascus and went there to bring these people as prisoners to Jerusalem to be punished. Have any of you traveled across this nation, across this world, in order to persecute Christians? Because I have. I actually was the one that many of these people even put their cloaks down whenever they were killing Stephen. Trust me, I'm zealous for Judaism, or I was. Verse 6. But about noon, as I came near Damascus, suddenly a bright light from heaven flashed around me. I fell to the ground, and I heard a voice say to me, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? Who are you, Lord? I asked. At this point, Paul has not mentioned the name Jesus yet. He's specifically avoided it. And even though he'll slip it in here in verse 8, throughout the rest of his dialogue, he still avoids it. He doesn't totally say it because he's not trying to get them to explode. He wants them to hear the whole message. I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom you are persecuting, he replied. My companions saw the light, but they did not understand the voice of him who was speaking to me. What shall I do, Lord? I asked. Get up, the Lord said, and go into Damascus. There you will be told all that you have been assigned to do. My companions led me by the hand to Damascus because the brilliance of the light had blinded me. A man named Ananias came to see me. He was a devout observer of the law. Why does he put that detail in there? Even the guy that converts me was a devout observer of the law, the thing you're accusing me of not doing, and highly respected by all the Jews living there. He stood beside me and said, Brother Saul, receive your sight. And at that very moment, I was able to see. Then he said, The God of our fathers has chosen you to know His will and to see the righteous one and to hear the words from His mouth. You will be a witness to all men in what you have seen and heard. And now what are you waiting for? Get up, be baptized, and wash your sins away, calling on His name. Notice, the place of honor that Jesus' name would take, he uses not to refer to Jesus' name. You're calling on His name. Whose name? His name. And if you want to know about how to define the word His, I can talk to you about that too. Verse 17 is where we'll pick up tomorrow. I love you guys. See you then.